Hi, everybody. I'm Linda Johnson, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous. In my home group, when you go, I'm nervous, everyone goes, aw. Thank you. I'd like to thank Dottie for not being perfect, because Lord knows I'm not. I'd like to thank Dottie and Pat, wherever she is, for coming and picking me up at the airport Friday night. It really was kind of a big deal to come all the way down the south side of Atlanta, and we had a nice opportunity to visit on the way back, and I'd been a little nervous about whether I would be here in time to hear Hank's story, and as many times as I've heard his story, I always like to be here. I always enjoy still hearing it. I'd also like to thank Dottie and Roy for being our hosts this weekend and for taking us to dinner and making sure all of our needs were taken care of, and I'd like to thank the committee for having us here, as well as for providing really nice gifts for us in our room, something to take back and remember you all by, something useful, which is really great. It's a ceramic vase or pitcher, or something we can use it for flowers or as a pitcher, I guess. So it's really been a lovely weekend here. I'm glad it's a little cooler today, I'll say that. But I've enjoyed the speakers. As I said, I always enjoy listening to my husband speak. That's what attracted me to him in the first place. And I enjoyed listening to Nancy tell her story yesterday morning and enjoyed Lee last night. I'd met Lee somewhere at a previous convention, but I hadn't heard his story, and it was really a remarkable story. I was very touched by it. And, but it reminded me, too, that we all come from different places, and alcoholism affects our lives in different ways. And I guess that's why we have so many different speakers, because, our routes to get here were all quite different. And I know that when I came to AA in my first months, I did a lot of comparing, and I did a lot of listening of, things that I had done and not done, and at first, it was, I think, that I didn't want to be here, and I was hoping that if I hadn't done the same things the other people had done, I wouldn't have to be here. But in short order, I wanted to be here, and then I was afraid I was a fraud. I was here by mistake or something, because I hadn't done some of the things that other people had done, or I'd done things that they apparently hadn't done. And so I did a lot of that comparing, and even though they say not to do that comparing, I found myself doing it anyway. But when I was maybe 3 or 4 months sober, I heard the man who is Hank's sponsor, Clancy, who many of you have heard, I'm sure, I heard him speak, and for me, he told me something that really allowed me to feel right about being here, and that was that my alcoholism wasn't based on, what made me an alcoholic was not what alcohol had done to me, it is what it had done for me, And alcohol did something for me that it does not do for my mother. And it didn't do for Nancy, evidently, when she got drunk that first time. If someone were to ask me, I heard a speaker say this one time, ask him what he thought alcohol was for him. And he said, it's the secret of life. And I could identify with that. Alcohol was the secret of life. And, I really didn't want to be an alcoholic, because I really couldn't imagine my life without alcohol, even though by the time I got here there were problems surrounding the alcohol, it still, in my mind, was not the problem, it was the solution. It was the solution to all these other problems that I had. And when I got to my first meeting, I was real confused about that first step. I knew I had this thing about alcohol and I had these problems in my life, but that's why I drank, because of the problem. I didn't recognize the connection between them. I'm not one of these people that crawled in here on my hands and knees off my last drunk. I'm one of these people who came to AA to basically get out of trouble, get my tail out of the crack. I was at a place in my life where people were asking me questions for which I couldn't come up with answers anymore. I couldn't explain away my behavior. I was really between a rock and a hard place. I was married for a number of years. By that point, I had 3 children who were, I think, about 7, 9, and 12 when I got sober. And I had separated from my husband and family. I'd moved out on my family. I'd moved into a little cottage on a lake. And it was really, presumably, it was because I'd have a trial separation from my husband. He and I weren't getting along at all. And what it was is that it seemed like the walls of my home had closed in around me. I got where I was just terribly uncomfortable in my home. And I was, even though I was drinking every day, I was restless, irritable, and discontented in my life. I couldn't stand the way my life felt anymore. And it was a geographic, really, to move out. But I felt like if I can get away from this family and, you know, if you have kids, you know, when I was newly married, I was quite a perfectionist. I would dust every rung of every chair on a regular basis. By the time I had kids and with my alcoholism progressing, my house was really unmanageable. It was not satisfying to live in that house. Everything kept piling up, the messes and the dishes and the laundry, and I would pretty much keep on top of it, but there was layers of things that kept building up, and it began to feel really oppressive, and I couldn't stay on top of it. I was just really unhappy there, and as I say, I took an opportunity to move into a little cottage on a lake about 16 miles from the family home. And I thought, if I can just get away from all the pressures in this home and from this bad marriage, I'll have a chance to think, and I'll be able to get my head straight, and I won't have to drink the way I'm drinking. And it was while I was living out at that cottage that the pressure really came to bear. My family was asking, well, if there's a problem in your marriage, how come you're the one moving out? And, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to get a divorce? Are you going to move back home? Or, you know, as it happened, I was involved with someone outside of my marriage at that point. And part of what I wanted to do is I wanted to be able to have that relationship in peace, but I also wanted to be a good wife and mother. And, you know, so every day I would drive back from that little cottage to my home at the time my children would get home from school, so I'd be there and be the good mom. It was very important to me to be the good mom. And I would do the shopping for that household, and I'd do the laundry for that household. And then when my husband got home, I'd split and go back to the cottage, to my other life is what I was doing. And I felt like I could just cover all the bases and keep everybody happy, and I would still be the, you know, you can see why I was running out of excuses and explanations. People weren't buying it. People weren't seeing how it was that I could have these two lives and successfully pull them off. And they were asking me what I wanted to do. And the fact is, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. Here I was involved with somebody that I thought I wanted to marry, but I didn't want to get divorced from my husband. You know, I didn't want to give up my husband. I didn't want to give up my children. I didn't want to give up my family. I didn't want to give up my outside relationship. And I sure didn't want to give up drinking. And that put a lot of pressure to bear. And what happened with me is that I was in therapy once again. I'd spent a lot of years of my life, from the time I was about in college on till the time I got sober at the age of 36, in therapy, in marriage counseling, and all kinds of different therapies, because I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I was unhappy. And the therapist that I was seeing at this point finally asked me about my drinking. And as I say, I was in a lot of pain and a lot of pressure from outside sources, and I was willing to cop out a little bit to my drinking. And she asked me if I would have an assessment, and for some reason I agreed to do that. And I put it off until after the Christmas holidays in 1981. In January of 1982, I went and I had that assessment. And for some reason, I was willing to be halfway honest about my drinking. And that's when I got sober. And I'll come back to that, just back off quite a bit about it and tell you what my drinking was like. But as I say, I came in through that route rather than crawling in off my last drug. I began drinking just about the end of high school. I'd always known it would be my birthright to drink. My family drank. They drank appropriately. They had the cocktail hour in our home. There was always, every social occasion had drinking. And it was all appropriate drinking. It was all very sophisticated looking. All the parties my family went to always involved cocktails. And we had the cocktail hour in our home, and we kind of had the children's hour. And I looked forward to leaving the children's hour and joining the cocktail hour because it always looked glamorous and sophisticated. And what I'd always wanted all my life was to be a grown-up. And growing up, I was much smaller than all the other kids, and I felt very, you know, age 12 or whatever, when the other girls started maturing and developing, I wasn't, and I just felt puny and insignificant. And I always wanted to be grown up, and I looked forward to that time in my life when you know, it would all come together for me. And I thought, well, maybe when I'm 10 years old, I'll have double digits, or when I'm 13, I'll be a teenager, or when I'm 14, maybe I'll be able to date, because I started to read these books about girls who were 14 and had dates, and or when I'm 16, I'll get my driver's license, or when I'm 18, then I'll be able to drink 3.2 beer in Ohio or something. I grew up in Michigan, and the drinking age was 21. Or when I'm 21, I'll be an adult. Always looking forward to the time when I will be an adult. And so the glamour of drinking around my parents and what they're doing always appealed to me. I fantasized from the movies and how glamorous it was all going to be. I was a great fantasizer as a kid. And so when I got to be about a senior in high school, and I was young for my grade, I graduated at 17, but I was close to 18, I thought. So I felt like that was, you know, this was the appropriate time to start drinking. And my parents had always allowed me to have a glass of wine at holidays and things like that. And I don't remember those glasses of wine doing too much for me, except I hated the way they tasted, but I always drank them all. And part of it was I wanted to be part of this grown-up world of sophistication. When I graduated from high school, I began to drink as my peers did. I was kind of a goody-two-shoes in high school, really. I think we all crave attention. Lord, we crave attention. I know I did. And I was able to get attention from doing the right thing for a long time. I was successful in school, and I had this feeling that a lot of us do, that somehow I had to be perfect in order to be acceptable. I had to be a little bit better than, just to be equal to. And for me, I could get attention in positive ways. And so, I was kind of a goody-two-shoes. However, I realized when I was a little kid that there were things that I wanted to do that didn't fit in with what was being expected of me from my family. And I wasn't going to turn down doing those things that I wanted to do. So I found ways to cover them up. And so from my earliest memories of me, I was a sneaky, you know, I had a sneaky, hidden, separate life that I wouldn't want you to know about. If I wanted to do something, by God, I'd do it, and I'd hide it. And if I got caught, I'd have an excuse. I explained my way out of everything. Whenever I got called on anything, I had some reason for it. I've always been pretty slick with my tongue, and I've always been able to rationalize and justify everything that I've wanted to do. And so for the time of early childhood, I had that separate, sneaky thing that I kept hidden. And yet I got to where I tried to judge myself the way I thought you were judging me. You know, I would look at my own external behavior and try to rationalize that I was okay because you said I was okay. But within me, there was always that sense that there was something different that I had to cover over. And I, as time went on, I began to think that I was some kind of a special creative force of some kind. You know, I read books about famous novelists and famous artists and famous musicians who were kind of eccentric and they did a lot of things that generally wouldn't be considered socially acceptable, but I mean, they were outrageous, but people loved them anyway and thought they were great because they were creative people. It was okay for them to have affairs and to be heavy drinkers and things like that. And so I began to develop those kinds of notions about me, that I had some special creative spark within me. And in fact, I had grandiose notions about myself since the time I was a kid. I remember when I was just a small, well, I was maybe 10 years old, and I can remember kind of looking at my hands and thinking that they kind of looked like the hands of Jesus, you know. And I would draw pictures of Jesus and think that that was kind of me. And I can remember fantasizing once, putting on an Easter pageant, and I would be Jesus hanging on the cross. Somehow that's how I felt about myself. But I also remember at age 10 thinking that I could be the little girl to be sent to the Soviet Union to deal with Nikita Khrushchev and bring about world peace. You know, that if I could just talk to him, I could do it, you know. I had notions about myself from early on. Anyway, all these fantasies and notions I had about myself, that I was still small and puny and not that sophisticated girl that I wanted to be. And so at age 17, 18, when I discovered drinking, some remarkable things changed in my life. And that was, suddenly, I could make my dreams come true. You know, I began to drink, and suddenly I began to feel the way I'd always wanted to feel. I began to feel full of myself, really. I began to feel self-confident and clever and like I could fit in. And and all the ways I wanted to be able to feel. I didn't realize that the alcohol was the thing that was enabling me to feel that way. I thought that I had just grown up. In fact, a significant event in my life, as I look at it now, is that my first semester of college, I came home for a weekend one time with some roommates, and my mother was out somewhere. And my mother had always been the kind of person who could keep me in line with just a raised eyebrow. And she'd give me the look, and it would just wither me. You know, if she'd call me on something, I just would cringe. And my mother had that kind of power over me. And on this occasion, she was out for an evening, and my friends and I were sitting there drinking beer. And my mother arrived home, and I met her at the door with a cigarette in one hand. She didn't know I smoked either, and a can of Budweiser in the other hand. And she gave me the look. And it didn't bother me. I remember that. I just smiled to myself. It didn't bother me. And my conscious thought at that moment that I still remember was, well, finally, I've grown up. That's what I thought it was. I had no idea that it was the alcohol that was enabling me to feel that way. But boy, you know, when alcohol did that for me, I came back every opportunity I could. I loved alcohol from the very beginning. I loved the way it made me feel. And off at college, I just went off on a tear. And, you know, in high school, I'd been so controlled and such a goody-two-shoes. And now at college, you know, you could go out in the middle of the week if you wanted to. And one of the first things I did at college is I bought fake ID that said I was 22. I was 17 and looked like I was 14, but I bought the ID that said I was 22 so I could go with the other kids that I'd met who liked to drink, and we'd go down to the tavern on a Wednesday night, start drinking pitchers of beer. I loved it from the beginning. And you didn't have to go to class if you didn't want to in college, and so I didn't. And I nearly flunked out my first semester, and I went on academic probation, and I was humiliated. My counselor asked if I shouldn't withdraw and go to an easier college, and I was just humiliated. How dare he think such a thing? And something happened in my second semester of college. I met him, and he went to the library. And if I wanted to be with him, I had to go to the library too. And so since I was there, I figured I might as well study. And that's how I didn't flunk out of college. I went there to be with him. But it was also important to me, you know, as soon as I met him, to make sure that we began to party together, and that he was a little bit older, and that he always buy a pint or later a fifth when we'd have our dates on the weekend. And actually, I didn't stop dating other guys right away. I started making the rounds of all the fraternity parties and things, and I began to develop a bad reputation, which was somewhat undeserved because I still had very strong morals and values and principles, which slid away later. But at this time, in the beginning of my drinking, it was really a conflict for me. It wasn't like today. This is when girls were really afraid about getting pregnant. And I did very, very strong prohibitions about certain things. But I placed myself in a position to be hurt many, many times. And they talk about date rape and stuff. And I was very lucky this didn't happen to me, because alcohol enabled me to carry out a lot of my fantasy. But the last minute, somehow I'd slip out of harm's way. And I got a bad reputation for what appeared to be my behavior. And I would be humiliated about that. How could they say such things about me? So from the very beginning of my drinking, things began to change, but it was subtle. And I had been, as I say, something of a controlled... I'd gone to church as a kid, and I'd been involved in a youth group in church and been an officer of that through high school. And then when I went off to college, I, like so many young people my age, I kind of killed God, and I philosophized God away. It was unnecessary for me. It was from that point on, I was out on my own, and I discovered alcohol, and I didn't know that was it, but I didn't find it necessary to subscribe to the same morals and values that I had before. And that I got these notions about myself as being some great creative spirit. And if anybody had implied that I went to college to get a husband, I would have been very humiliated or very outraged, because I thought that I was going there to become something great. I don't know what, because as soon as I graduated from college, I got him to marry me, you know. And, I wasn't going to face life on my own resources. I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had notions about myself. But the fact of it is that there are a lot of things in my life that I wanted to do before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous that I was just terrified to do. If it didn't come easily to me, if I wasn't good at it, that I wasn't even going to try it, lest I fail. And I had to smile when Nancy was talking about her cheerleader career, because I always secretly wanted to be a cheerleader, but I was afraid to go out for cheerleading lest I wouldn't be good enough and not get on the squad, and that would have been way too humiliating. I also secretly wanted to be on the swim team, and I was afraid to go out for that because I thought maybe I wouldn't be good enough. So I only did the things that I knew I was good enough to do and take pride from them. And in college, you know, I said that I wanted to be a writer, but I was afraid to submit anything that I had written to any kind of a review or to any kind of a publication, lest it be rejected and I'd find out that I wasn't good enough. So it was always this potential that I had, that if I really wanted to do it, I knew I could do it, but I never was going to try to do it because I couldn't bear the idea of failing. One of my reactions to this kind of thing was to put down the people who were doing those things. You know, so for my money, all those cheerleaders were little blonde bimbos. I didn't want to have anything to do with them. And the real intellectual in-crowd, well, they were a bunch of eggheads and nerds. And the women athletes, we all know what we want to call them. You know, so I had ways of putting down everything that I was really secretly afraid to try to do. And so I really limited myself, and it was not until I got sober that I had to begin to examine that and to begin to take some risks in my life and to try things and realize that I didn't have to be perfect. Anyway, after I graduated from college, I got married to him right away, and I had the idea that my satisfaction was going to come from being a homemaker, a wife, and a mother. And I worked for a couple of years after I was first married, and I didn't like that too well, so we decided to have a family. And we had our three planned children. And I had the idea that my children would somehow bring glory to me. You know, that I would have some of the smartest, most successful children, and they would really always, they'd be able to do some of the things that I kind of secretly had always wanted to do. Maybe they'd be cheerleaders or something. And so from the time my first child was born, we started buying her these fancy, creative playthings, toys. And I wanted her to, maybe I'd have her walking by the time she was 8 months old or something. And I bought her this one thing called a crawligator. It was kind of a dolly with casters on it. And the idea was you could put a baby about 6 weeks old on there, and the random motion of their arms and legs would get them to sort of navigate around. And you know, it would be a way to get them to crawl early. And I certainly wanted my child to crawl early and to stand early, pull herself up early and walk early and talk early and do everything early, because that would be a reflection on me, what a wonderful mother I was. But I'd put, you know, I should have known this course for my life was going to be a failure from the get-go, because I put that six-week-old baby on there and all she'd do is spit up and cry, you know. And that was the story of my parenthood, you know, all my dreams of my children's success and they were just kids. They were just regular kids who did everything in their own time the way kids do. But I somehow felt that it was all going to be a reflection on me. And so those early years of my marriage, early years of being a mom, were in many ways, you know, and I was ashamed of that. You know, I hid that. And it was something I had to deal with in my inventories, that I had resentments towards my own children for not bringing glory to me. And the fact is that I didn't know how to be a good mom. I didn't know how to accept my children where they were and give them love and support and nurturance and help them to do things and let them do it at their own pace. And so I would be, you know, alternately scolding them for not doing well and humiliated. And, you know, it's very painful when I think back on it today, but I didn't know any better. But it wasn't a satisfying period of my life after all. And so after a few years of this, having these kids who were beginning instead to bring home notes from the school saying that they needed to see the school psychologist, that they were maladjusted in some way, or they didn't seem to have friends, or people were picking on them at school, and other things that I found very humiliating. You know, I loved my kids very much, but this was very painful to me, that they couldn't really be the successful athletes and scholars and cheerleaders and popular kids that I kind of always wanted to be myself. And of course, over the years, my alcoholism was progressing and my self-centeredness was progressing, and I had less and less time to devote to them and to helping them and to being a good mother for them. And more I became concerned with me and how I felt. And I, over the period of years, I became more and more and more self-centered, and it was all about me. And am I happy? Am I happy? Am I happy? What does it take to make me happy? And by now, it's getting to be the 70s, and it's really getting into kind of the me generation. And there are lots of books about, books out, self-help books out about how to meet your own needs or how to make sure your needs are met, getting our needs met. And as I say, I went to a lot of therapy, and in the therapy it was a matter of identifying your own needs and making sure that they're met. And by God, I sure got on board with that. And all of the therapy that I went to prior to getting to Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, was about finding out what he had done wrong, you know, or what they had done wrong, and no wonder I feel the way I feel. It was all about blaming and being a victim. And I would have these wonderful insights in my therapy in which I realized that the reason I was so unhappy was because of my parents' divorce or because my husband this or somebody that, you know. And that was, and I would have these moments of, you know, it would be remarkable how good I would feel coming out of my therapy having had these insights. But what I didn't recognize was that I wasn't getting any better. You know, figuring out why I was so unhappy because of them didn't do one thing to make me feel any better. And so despite all of this therapy, you know, I continued for years to be restless, irritable, and discontented. And I became, from early on, a regular drinker. And from early on, I became a daily drinker. And just to tell you a little bit about how I got to drinking, with the exception of one experiment a couple years before I got sober, where I went 8 days without drinking, with the exception of that, I didn't go one day without drinking for years. And even when I was in the hospital having babies, I would have my husband bring in a flask to celebrate having the babies. And I had the doctor prescribe beer for me so that because I was nursing my babies. And it was, they actually did this. I don't think they do this anymore, but they actually would have beer for me in the hospital with those labels that you get on medication, right on the bottles of beer. And then I would demand them, and the nurses would bring them to me. And so, you know, even in the hospital, I was drinking. And that's how I got through life, is drinking, drinking, drinking. And early on, I was a scotch drinker. I loved drinking scotch. But as I say, I had these three kids, and I needed to look like a good mother and a good wife. And you can't be an all-day long scotch drinker and still hold it together. And so, like so many women I've heard do, I pretty much switched to beer and wine, because I could drink more beer and wine over more time and get into less trouble than drinking the hard stuff. I didn't give up the hard stuff altogether, but I became kind of a maintenance drinker from early on. I got to where I would find, of course, reasons and excuses to do the drinking, like if you do the lawn work, then, you know, if you cut the grass, you get to drink beer. Everybody knows that. So I had taken on a lot of these household tasks. I did the lawn work, and I went up on the ladder and painted the gutters and all those kinds of things. He was working. I was at home with the kids. And I took on all these tasks, and I could drink beer. In fact, I needed to drink beer before going up on the ladder. Anybody would understand that. If you're going to climb up on the roof, you need to drink before you do that, you know. And it enabled me to do things. I saw alcohol not as a problem, but as the thing that made everything else possible. It allowed me to feel the way I wanted to feel for a long, long time. And so I'd do the yard work, and if you iron, you can always drink beer when you're ironing. Everybody knows that too. You get hot over the iron, you drink beer. So, you know, it looked legitimate. Or I'm lying around, we had a wading pool or something, I'd be out there with the kids and lying in the hot sun. And so what if it's 11 o'clock in the morning, you're lying out in the sun, you have a beer. And so I'd become kind of an all day long, little bit, little bit, little bit drinker. And I did this for years. And I'd get gallon bottles of white wine. And I was very particular about what I drank, because I also suffered horrible, horrible hangovers. My hangovers turned into migraine headaches. I still get migraine headaches, and that's a vascular headache, which is very much like a hangover headache. And so with that tendency to get that kind of headache, I had to be real careful about what I drank, and I knew that red wines were more apt to bring on a headache, and gin was apt to bring on a headache, and I would never mix my liquor with soda pop. I knew that would bring on a headache. And I remember once reading about if you would eat activated charcoal, it would absorb the impurities in the alcohol. You know, when you hear about all the hangover remedies and the things that, you know, before you go to bed at night, you take two Alka-Seltzers, you do this, you do that. or line your stomach before you, you know, all the things. I was always looking for ways to drink without getting into trouble with it, because I would get into terrible trouble. And what would happen is I would get these horrible migraines or hangover headache that would turn into a migraine, and then I'd start popping pills. I took a lot of codeine, and I needed more and more and more, and then Percodan and tranquilizers to try to deal with the side effects of all of this. And I'd say, I'm not going to do this again tomorrow. Not, you know, I am going to ease off this booze. I'm going to give myself a couple days to feel better. And then, you know, I'd find if I'd have a beer, it would calm me down and make me feel quite a lot better. And then I would start drinking again, right on top of this headache. I'd be, you know, I'd be on all this codeine, and then I'd start to drinking the beer and feeling better, and I'd be off and running again. So I'd gone through, you know, managing this daily drinking, you know, became a bit of a problem early on. But I was always looking for solutions in terms of hangover remedies and stuff, never the idea of cutting back, getting rid of the alcohol. You know, in chapter 3 in our book, it talks about all of the things that we can try, you know, taking a trip, not taking a trip, and switching brands and all of this stuff. And I tried everything that I could to continue to drink, because I loved what it was doing for me for a long, long time. But I would get these gallon bottles of white wine, which is the least apt to give me a hangover, I thought, and I'd have those in the refrigerator. And it seemed like every time I'd pass through the kitchen, that bottle of wine would be calling to me. And so I'd be in there, and I'd have that jug up, and I would be drinking it right out of the bottle. I'd given up glasses long ago, or if we had liquor up in the cabinet, I would be drinking it right out of the bottle. And I was afraid my kids were going to come through the kitchen and see me doing this. And so I was furtive about it, but, you know, I'd quickly do it. But every time I'd come through the kitchen, I'd feel the need to do that. And then it got to wherever I had to do anything or go anywhere. You know, I'd load the kids in the car, and I'd have to run back in the house and have a few big swigs or whatever. Or I'd go camping with them, and I'd have it in the trunk of the car, and I'd send them on ahead, and I'd be back drinking out of the trunk of the car. You know, over time, it got to, in order to do anything at all, I needed to drink to fortify myself. And, you know, over time, it gets harder and harder to live like that, because I knew that they were watching the level of that wine in the bottle in the refrigerator. So I got in another gallon bottle of white wine, and I kept it in the trash barrel out in the attached garage in a brown paper bag. And I would carry the one from the refrigerator out to the garage, and I'd refill it a little bit, and I'd put it back in there. And then level dropped again, I'd be out refilling it again. I also was rather pretentious. I had a wine cellar. I bought expensive, very expensive wines. I had all the wine books and vintage charts, and I would serve the finest wines to people. But those were not the ones that I did for my regular drinking. I'd go down in the wine cellar, and I'd pull out from underneath the wine bottle something I'd bought for about a buck and a half, and I'd drink out of a bottle, you know, sitting on the floor of my wine cellar, inspecting all of my fine wines. Now, that was my drinking wine, and the other was my showing-off wine. And, you know, I had to, you know, I had to scrap around the house to find pocket change from my husband's pockets or from my kids' pockets, to go over and buy wine sometimes, because I always had to protect my supply. And there are times when wine and beer weren't really enough, and I'd feel like I wanted a little something else, and there wasn't anything around, so I'd have to go over to the liquor store, and I showed up at Ray's Liquors quite a lot. And after a while, I was pretty sure that they were keeping track of how many times I was going there. So I'd go to other liquor stores. But sometimes the other liquor stores were too far away, and I'd find myself back at Ray's a little too soon, so I'd have to come up with an excuse why I was there. And I'd have to explain to them something like, you know, my in-laws are coming for a visit and they like to drink martinis. What kind of gin do you think they'd like? And get their recommendation. And whatever they said, I'd take it out there. Or, I'm planning to make a rum cake. Do you think I should get the amber rum or the dark rum? You know, and it didn't matter what I was buying. I was buying whatever I could think of a reason to be buying that they would accept. And, you know, then I'd be out in the car and I'd be drinking whatever that was out of the brown paper bag in my car before I even left the parking lot. And when I bought things that I knew my family didn't think we had, like rum or gin or whatever, and by this time, I'll tell you, my then husband had stopped drinking himself because he had gallbladder trouble. And that made it really awkward for me, because he knew we didn't have to have these other things around the house. I knew he was keeping track. So when I'd have these empty bottles, I couldn't put them in our trash, because I knew that he might look in there and he'd see an empty rum bottle and he'd begin to wonder about that. So I'm one of those people occasionally would slip it into the neighbor's trash. Or moreover, I found another place to put them. I remembered seeing empty whiskey bottles down by the railroad tracks. So I'd drive down by, and I knew who put them there, too. And I'd drive down by the railroad tracks and toss my empties down there. You know, and it never occurred to me that there was that I had anything in common with the other people that were putting their empties down there. It was more like they were just showing me a good place to get rid of empties. You know. But, you know, it's a lot of work. If you were a housewife, closet, sneaky, hidden drunk, or not even a housewife, if you're a man trying to hide his drinking, it gets to be a lot of work. And it almost was, there might have been even some excitement in the game of it, I don't know. There was one time when my husband came home for lunch, and I told him I had the flu and that I was very sick. And he said, well, what are you going to do this afternoon? I said, I'm just going to go to bed. I'm so sick. And as soon as he left to go back to work, I took off to the grocery store, one of these warehouse food places, to buy my wine. And I'm standing there at the checkout with this gallon bottle of white wine, and there he is. And he saw, you know, he saw me in there after I told him I was sick. He never said anything about that. You know, and I must have got where I smelled. I can smell liquor on somebody's breath 100 feet away today, you know, but I must have just reeked of it at all times. But when he'd be coming home for dinner, I would take a big blob of peanut butter or eat certs or something, thinking I was covering this up. And I asked him, you know, sometime after I got sober, what did he think was going on? And he admitted he didn't understand the nature of alcoholism either, and there were times when he was kind of concerned about my drinking, but he bought my explanations. You know, I told him I could handle it. As far as I was concerned, I could handle my drinking, because I thought as long as I was able to walk, that I wasn't drunk, you know? In fact, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and heard this word drunk so often, I was offended, because I thought I didn't get drunk, because I felt as long as I was on my feet, I wasn't drunk. You know, and I had tried for years to not slur my speech and to be able to walk without staggering. But there are many, many occasions where I would just really hold it together, and then I'd get home from one of those evenings and I'd go out in the yard to walk the dogs or something, and I would be knee-walking drunk. I don't know if that's ever happened to you, that suddenly you get struck drunk, you know, right, you know, at the end there, and you could barely crawl back to the house. I'd be so drunk. But I'd have held it together for a long time. And the reason it was so important for me to hide how drunk I was I couldn't afford to take the chance of somebody questioning me about my drinking. I knew that if they pointed the finger at me and asked me about my drinking, I knew the implications of that. And I couldn't imagine my life without alcohol. I couldn't take the chance. I couldn't be called on my drinking. And I know there are a lot of us who drink openly and just say, you know, I'll drink as much as I want, and you have nothing to say about it. But here, it was real important to me to keep this husband and this family and this image and my kids and all of that together, you know, and so I was really playing the game to look like I was doing the right thing, but by God, I was going to do what I needed to do. And as I said, that was part of the pressure that was going on within me, you know, where I moved out to this cottage. And as I say, in the fall of 1981, I moved out into this little cottage on the lake, and I was sleeping on a mattress on the floor. We had a wood-burning stove out there, and it was rolling into a Wisconsin winter. And to me, this seemed, I was a nature girl, too. I'll tell you, part of this dual life that I developed had to do with me being a bird watcher. It's odd, I know, but one has to find interests outside of the home. And my interest... I became a bird watcher, and I found people that I could associate with. I was in a bird club, and I was involved in the State Ornithological Society, and I could go to meetings, and I found the bird watchers that liked to drink like I did, and I found bird watchers that were very, very attractive, too. And so I could have this separate life, and I could go off on weekend field trips and get my husband to take care of the children while I was away, and I felt entirely justified to have my own separate life. You know, after all, he had his career and he was also a musician on weekends, and so I had my own life off with the bird watchers and, you know, doing my thing out in the woods. And I'd get sometimes confused about which life I was in, because they thought, you know, they thought certain things about me. They thought about me the way I wanted people to think about me. They didn't know me the way my family and other people knew me, that I could be out there with them. And so when I moved out in this little cottage, that was part of the big bird-watching deal, you know. I could be out there in nature or something. And as I say, families weren't buying this, and my husband certainly wasn't buying it. He was very distressed that I had moved out, and he wasn't satisfied that I would come back each day and do the laundry and do the grocery. You know, it was also functional for me to do the grocery shopping for the family because I was really still on, you know, living off his paycheck primarily. I had some money that I'd earned from teaching bird classes, but that I was paying the rent of this cottage, but I still needed to eat. So I'd do the grocery shopping for the family, and I'd buy two cases of beer, one for the house and one for the cottage, so that when I'd come home each day to be with the children, after they got home from school, there'd be plenty for me to drink there, and there'd be plenty out at the cottage. And it was a crazy way to live, you know, and I wasn't getting any closer to any answers, and I was getting more and more pressure. So when I was asked to take this assessment, it was kind of like the way, you know, maybe I can sort of postpone the decisions. And so, as I say, when I came back in January of 1982 and took this assessment, and I was somewhat honest about my drinking, you know, I didn't want to hear her say the words. And in fact, I kind of didn't let her say the words, alcoholic, but I knew from all of the ways that I answered her questions just what she was thinking. And she told me about treatment centers. There's a treatment center there where I had the assessment and the program. And I didn't know anybody who had had any kind of treatment for alcoholism or had been to a treatment center or anything like that. I knew nothing about that. But it didn't seem to me that I was physically ill to the point where I had to go to the hospital. But she also had a meeting directory of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. Subliminally over the years, somehow it had, I knew that AA was the place that alcoholics went that worked. Now, I just knew that. It had a good reputation. I don't know if it's from hearing some of those public service announcements late at night or reading articles or glancing at articles over the years or seeing Days of Wine and Roses or, you know, where I got that idea. I had no idea what went on at Alcoholics Anonymous, but I knew that that was the thing that worked. And so, I left that assessment with a meeting directory. And this therapist, counselor I was seeing, who really didn't understand anything about alcoholism, said that there was a test in AA that if you could just drink two, you weren't an alcoholic. I don't know where she got that. But I went home that night out to my little cottage, and I drank two beers, and I stopped. And I was going to be able to go and tell them the next night that I wasn't an alcoholic. And so the next night, I went to my first AA meeting. And I didn't drink that night because I didn't think it would be fair to go walk into an AA meeting having drank. So I went in there, and I was going to tell them about how I had had the two the night before. But by the time it got around to me, and they had a first step meeting, and they went around the table. And by the time it got around to me, I didn't feel like I needed to say that to them. I didn't. I'd heard enough. And, you know, I don't know what it was for me at that first meeting. As I said, I was doing a lot of comparing and a lot of, I haven't done that, and I haven't done that, and I would never do that, and I hadn't been to jail, I hadn't gotten a DWI, and, you know, and I wasn't a barroom drinker, and, you know, these things. But there was something that I was hearing there, evidently, that I must have had some little bit of identification, because that night I went home after that meeting, and I poured the rest of my alcohol down the sink. And I haven't had a drink since. That was January 13th, 1982. And it's really amazing because, you know, when I took that action, I didn't say drinking forever. You know, that's not how I got sober. In fact, if that thought had dawned on me, you'll never have another drink, I think I would have thought twice about putting it down there. I couldn't face that kind of a thought. I got here, I was unsure that I was an alcoholic. I had all kinds of doubts about it. I knew I had some things about drinking. It had been plaguing me and bothering me for years. I knew that my life was a mess. But I wasn't prepared to say, I'll never take another drink. I didn't know for sure I was an alcoholic, but I was willing to come to meetings and not drink. You know, and I think that's so important, and I tell newcomers that today. You don't have to know if you're one. You always have the option to go back out if this isn't where you belong. You know, but for me it was important to just not drink and come to meetings. And in fact, this man that I was involved with, I had given him some grapes. We had a grape arbor, and I'd given him grapes, and he was going to make wine. And he said, well, then you won't be able to drink the wine I'm making. And I thought, well, sure I will, because, you know, next year, I don't know what, you know, But I wasn't prepared to think about forever or anything like that. I was just willing to not drink right today. And that's how I got sober, one day at a time. And it's funny because I always thought that the slogans that I saw, as soon as I got to AA and saw those slogans, they seemed so incredibly corny to me. So self-evident and corny. And what is the meaning of that, you know? But they're so profound. And that is truly the way I got sober, is one day at a time. I was willing to not drink and to come to meetings. However, I wasn't real sincere in the beginning. And part of this was surely, as I say, trying to keep me out of trouble and trying to prove to all the people who were asking me all these questions, you know, that I was, you know, I had serious problems. I always wanted to have serious problems. In fact, even when I was seeing a psychiatrist, I wanted to have a serious diagnosis. You know, I didn't want to have a neurosis, because that sounded too fuss-budgety, you know. I wanted to have I wanted a psychosis of some kind. You know, something really serious so that people would really feel sorry for me and understand why it was I wasn't doing anything in my life, you know, as it turns out. You know, I never really wanted to take responsibility for anything in my life, and I wanted to have good reasons for it. And I wanted you to understand the good reasons. Anyway, I explained to my then husband, from whom I was still separated, of course, that I had this drinking problem and now I'd gone to AA. And he said, well, yeah, but are you going to move back home? And I said, well, I don't know. I think I need to kind of get my life in order and think about things longer. And anyway, he got very impatient with me. And this is my first couple weeks of sobriety. And I just kept dancing him because I really thought maybe I'll be able to continue this other relationship and I'll be able to get the heat off. And, you know, I had these thoughts. And what happened to me was that when I was 2 or 3 weeks sober, he filed for divorce and he asked for custody of our 3 children. And he was going to show that I had abandoned them and that I was not a fit mother. And when I got this news, sober a couple of weeks, I was devastated. Because as I said, I loved my family, and it was very, very important to me to be, that was part of my big, big thing in my life, family. Even though I didn't want to be with them, I still wanted to have them in some sense. But I was devastated. I just threw a tantrum like we do and just screamed and carried on and was going to kill myself or always going to kill ourselves. And he really gets on. And a neighbor came over and calmed me down. And after she calmed me down, I sat down on this mattress on the floor of my little cottage and I started reading in the big book. And I'd gotten the big book, but I hadn't read much of anything in it. I happened to open the book and be flipping through and reading. And I happened to read the part right after How It Works about the third step, where it talks about selfishness and self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our problem. And it talks about that trying to run the show and trying to get our own way. And if only people would do like we want them to, everything would be great. But they don't, so we try harder. And then they still don't, and our feelings are hurt, and all of this stuff. You know, and I recognized myself. I had my moment of clarity, and Lee was talking about that last night. I had my moment of clarity. I recognized that was me. You know, all the time that I've been putting out this stuff to people, what I wanted them to believe about me, and there's always been these little voices within me, you know, with knowing that wasn't really the truth. And I recognized, you know, the absurdity of the way I was living and that I had indeed this disease of self-centeredness and that I needed this thing. And I still wasn't clear, really, with the first 2 steps. I wasn't sure about how the drinking and the alcoholism, I wasn't convinced about that, but I could certainly see that I had that self-centeredness. And I can remember a time when I was trying to reason that if my husband truly loved me, he would give me unconditional love, and that it would be unconditional to the point that it would be okay if I had affairs with other men, because he would want me to be happy. But I can remember at the time that I had these thoughts, thinking there's no way in hell that I would grant this to him. In fact, whenever I had any suspicion along those lines, I'd fly into a rage. I was very rageful. I would have terrible temper tantrums and scream and hit and throw things. And I heard something about throwing some lasagna yesterday, and I threw my lasagna at the ceiling. and knocking over TVs and jumping out of cars that were still moving and things like that. Boy, you know, I had a short fuse. And anyway, kind of lost my train of thought there for a minute with the lasagna. Anyway, I recognized that I had the disease of self-centeredness and that I needed this thing. And that's where, and I happened to go to an AA meeting. I'd been in the women's movement in the 70s because I'd been generally pissed off. And men were as good a target as any, you know. So, as I said, I was restless, irritable, and discontented, even drinking. And so when I looked through the meeting directory, there was a women's group. And that appealed to me because of that old thing about women's rights and all that. So I went to that, and thank God that I went to that, because that was a meeting that was a spin-off meeting of the group that became my home group, which is a strong action home group. And at this little women's meeting, they would always say, "Do you have a sponsor? You know, have you got a sponsor yet?" And about the third time I went there, I got a little tired of them asking me that, so I asked a woman to be my sponsor. And this was a woman who had reached out to me when I first went to the meeting, who'd stuck her hand out and noticed me walking through the door. You know, and you know, that's so important to me today. I try, in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the things that I've really tried to work on is just to develop an awareness of others. You know, it's so easy, I think, once we get comfortable in our own groups, to come in and see our friends and go and talk to the people that we're comfortable talking to and not notice the people walking through the door who may be there for the first meeting, and to draw them in. Because, you know, Curtis, we were talking about this recently. Anybody who gets to an AA meeting is there because they need help. You know, nobody walks in for just no reason at all. And even if they're defiant and hateful and standing behind the post and acting like they don't want you to touch them, they're there because they need help. And I think our most important 12-step work, maybe not in trying to bring people to the program so much as trying to keep people in the program, the people who find their way here, who have made that initial surrender or whatever. There's some kind of surrender or they wouldn't be here, and to me in that way. And, you know, I hated the way I felt when I got to AA because I was sober, and I didn't know how to be around people sober. I hated the way I felt when I came into a big meeting. I felt like everybody knew somebody. They already knew who to talk to, and they're in their little cliques, I thought. And I felt ill at ease and self-conscious. And that's why I drank, because I didn't like the way I felt around people. And here I was sober in AA, and even though there were other alcoholics, I still felt acutely ill at ease and self-conscious for a long time. And here at that women's meeting, a woman had reached out her hand to me, and that's who I asked to be my sponsor. And she's still my sponsor today, although it's long distance. This is the person that I allow to really get to know me, and that I allow to, you know, that I check out my perspectives with, because I get too emotionally involved with me, and I need somebody who can be objective about me and can set me straight. And this is the woman who took me through the steps, and this is the woman who heard my fifth steps, and keeps current with where I'm at and what I'm doing. And anyway, she brought me to the group that became my home group, which is the Badger group in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and where I had my first 5 years of sobriety. And as I say, it was an action group with strong sponsorship and strong commitment to the group, and I learned to be accountable there. And I say, I was not comfortable being sober, especially in a big group of people, but I was required to come to the meeting early and to have fellowship, and I was required... Actually, it was suggested that I go out for coffee after the meeting, and I thought a suggestion was something that I could do or not do. And then my grand sponsor said to me one day, "Didn't Pat suggest that you go out to coffee?" And I said, "Well, she suggested that." She said, "Well, that means you do it." Now, I was a little slow to get that anything my sponsor suggested was something that would be in my best interest. And so I began to do some of these things, even though I hated doing them. I didn't want to go out to coffee with the AA people. I remember one of the first times I went out there, we sat at a table in a restaurant, and everybody was laughing and joking and telling off-color stories, and I thought, this isn't funny. I don't know what they're laughing about. And I had the idea that they were putting on this laughter just to fool me, just to make me think there was something fun going on here. And because it wasn't fun to me, it's where I was at. And we had birthday parties in our group, and people would bring goofy cards, and I hated going to the birthday parties. And you know, I would think, this isn't funny, and who am I going to sit with, and who am I going to talk with? I was the kind of kid growing up that I had one best friend, and if I went to school and my one best friend wasn't there, then I was very uncomfortable, and you know, I'd have to go and try to sit with a group of people that I knew didn't want me there. You know, I knew the other kids didn't want me around, and I felt this way coming into AA. That's why I drank. You know, Hank said it Friday night when he had feelings about asking women out and stuff. You know, he realized why he drank in the first place. But what I found in AA was that I had to face and work through all these things sober. That at the time that I started drinking, you know, drinking was the alternative to growing up. Drinking was the alternative to learning how to deal with life and cope and face life on life's terms. And so I had to pick up where I'd left off at age 17 and learn how to socialize and to be okay with it. And it's okay to make small talk. I was one of those people who would like to say that, you know, I'd go to a cocktail party and I'd find that one interesting person and sit off in the corner with that one interesting person and have a deep intellectual conversation. And the fact is, I'd glom onto somebody because I didn't know how to mix and how to socialize and how to be comfortable doing it. But, you know, when I came to AA, I didn't want you to realize I felt that way, so I faked it, kind of, you know. But I was very, very uncomfortable. But there's so many things that I've had to learn how to do here in AA so that I could carry them out into my life. You know, I think there are a lot of meetings that you can go to where you come in the meeting and you hear the theory about it, you hear the discussion about it, and then you go out there and try to practice it in your life. But I feel very fortunate that I came into a group where so much of these lessons we practice within the group, within the meeting, by having fellowship with people, by being involved with people in service work, by having commitments at the meeting, cleaning up and setting up and all these kinds of things that we do that required me to be involved with people in the group and learning to be responsible. That there was a structure within the group, enough structure within the group, to give me opportunities to practice some of these living skills that I hadn't acquired. And little by little, I could carry those living skills out into the rest of my life. And that's what has happened with me. I have a life today. I say, when I was sober for 5 years, I'd moved back in with my husband, by the way. He was willing to call off the divorce action after a period of time, and he got involved in Al-Anon, and we were able to put the marriage back together on a pretty good basis for 5 years. Then we moved down to Charlotte, and there were some issues in that marriage that had never been fully addressed because it seemed just too hard to do it. And when I was cut loose from my sponsored, my strong home group and got down to Charlotte, at 5 years of sobriety, the meetings I was going to, my ego took off because they thought here I was this great hope from the north or something. I don't know what they thought, but I was being asked to speak at a lot of meetings and everybody seemed to be real interested in what I had to say. And my ego took off and my long-distance sponsor, I couldn't hear very well. You know, I'd hear her on the phone and then I would think, but you don't understand, really, you're not here. And I began to make some poor decisions and I broke up my marriage, and I think it's something that needed to be done, but not in the way that I did it. I did it by getting back into old ideas, and I became involved with somebody in AA. And I was very attracted to the glamour of this. This was somebody who'd spent a lot of time in prison and who seemed to be quite a miracle, and at the same time in AA that I did, and I was drawn to this great image, and the thing is that my disease, and this is something I had to understand later, my sponsor helped me work through, is that whether I'm drinking or not, my disease can come back full force, and my ability to deceive myself can be absolutely astonishing. And in this relationship, I saw what I wanted to see, and rationalize what I didn't want to see, and the fact that this guy still carried a 38 and that lived in his old ideas too, I was able to push that aside, and the fact that I began to find evidence that he was smoking pot and not really sober, I was able to push that information aside too. And so I put myself through a couple of years of extreme emotional pain because I'd broken up my marriage and I was sober. And I had to make it look like I'd done the right thing, and that this man and I were going to go off into the long road of happy destiny together and be this wonderful AA couple. And I had to get involved in Al-Anon at that time. And Al-Anon, in fact, saved my bacon. It saved my life because I became so sick in this relationship. And you know, I guess we all have to do what we have to do, and I learned a lot from going through that, and I grew in some very important ways, because finally, for the first time in my life, I truly did take responsibility for myself. I had to get a job that paid, had benefits, and that was a career direction. I had dabbled in a career for several years, and part-time, and now I had to be working full-time with benefits. I had to get credit in my own name, and I had to take responsibility for myself emotionally, because this sick person could not do that for me. And I had to begin to rely on my programs and remember that my security and serenity can't depend on another person, on any other person, but on the power that I've gotten here. I had to get back to that. And I had to get in enough pain to make the surrender to get back to that and to leave that situation. And I was fortunate that I was able to do that and to get out and rent my own place and be on my own and have some time to just be me, not attached to another person. And Hank mentioned it Friday night, that when he and I met, we had both been autonomous and self-supporting through our own contributions. It was real necessary for me to leave a relationship without having another one to jump into. And it turned out that that guy that I had been actually married to for a very brief time in sobriety, his life went south. I mean, he ended up doing life in the federal penitentiary for murder one. He took all his anger on one person, and thank God it wasn't me, but it was his business partner. And, you know, the lessons that we learn from the things that we put ourselves through. And I went through a period of that where I wanted again to be the victim. And I wanted people in AA to think, you know, I was a good wife and I was a good person and I didn't do him wrong and, you know, all of this kind of stuff. But I have to understand, too, that our troubles are always of our own making and that we place ourselves in a position to be hurt. And I'd forced myself into the life of somebody who was obviously not capable of carrying the burden of my needs as well as his own. And I don't take responsibility for the actions that he took, but for the pain that I suffered by insisting on staying in a sick dependent relationship because of my fantasies and my expectations, rather than accepting someone with the limitations he had and recognizing those. My life today, I'm kind of running over here, my life today is very different. I said, you know, that I had this notion of being a great creative force, and As it turns out, in sobriety, I was able to take some risks, and I developed a career, and today I am a writer. You know, that thing that I said I wanted to be in college but had no way of getting to, in sobriety, I was able to take the actions little by little to become a writer. I'm a copywriter in advertising, and I have a career that I enjoy, you know, and I think that another thing that sobriety can do for us, I believe that we all have within us our God-given talents, and they're all very, very different, and some people's talents may be pushing a broom or singing a song or you know, dealing with people or being in sales. You know, we all have things that we're suited to do, and I was able to develop the gifts that I had to where I have a career where I enjoy doing what I'm doing. I ended up having good relationships with my kids today. My kids are 26, 24, and almost 21. And they've gone their routes, too. One of them was in Alcoholics Anonymous for 5.5 years. She came in at 14, and at 19 and a half, she decided to go back out because she'd missed out on some really important psychedelic drugs. She's a Grateful Dead follower and hippie, and she doesn't drink today. She knows she can't drink, and she's back in college, and I'm glad that she's not out there driving drunk and stealing money from people and doing the things she was doing when she was 14. But I think she's going to need to find her way back here because she's holding on to some other options that I think are going to keep her stuck. But I have a good relationship with her, and I've set my own example. And I have to realize that with my kids, that's all I can do, is set my own best example. You know, they know what I'm doing, and I don't have to preach to them. And I can be there, and I can love them without enabling them. And, you know, if they need it, it's here. My older daughter is a straight arrow person. She went through her time in high school when she was kind of wild, and somehow she found her way through. And, you know, for me it's so important today as I see my kids as adults to realize I made a lot of mistakes as a mom. I wasn't real You know, but I did the best that I could with what I had and what I knew. And when I knew better, I began to do better. But to know that my kids have their own higher powers as well, and they have their own stories to write, and they have the example of sober people around them in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon, and that if they're not happy with their lives, they don't have to be victims and blame mom and dad, that they can get involved in a program of their own or take responsibility for their own lives. And I don't see, my kids don't see themselves as victims. See, my older daughter's kind of straightened out and become a very conservative person, which really amazes me considering what she was like in high school. And then I have my middle daughter, as I say, who was in the program and still tries to live by a spiritual basis. She just feels it's a little more spiritual with ganja. So my son doesn't know if he might or might not be an alcoholic. He's soon to turn 21. He doesn't drink or use drugs. As he says, he wants to feel it all. You know, he doesn't want to change his perception of reality. And he loves to listen to AA speaker tapes, and he loves to go to open AA meetings. And I'm real grateful for that today. And I think part of the reason my kids are finding their own way is that I am not forcing them anyway. So I have good relationships with them today. And as you heard Friday night, Hank and I began our relationship together about 4.5 years ago. And it is so gratifying to be in a relationship, in a sober relationship with a truly sober person who has good sobriety, and to have these be the principles that we practice in our lives. So I guess with that, I'd like to thank you all for being here this morning and for being part of my sobriety today.